Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller. I'm really happy to have you along today. And we're going to talk a little about the UW Arboretum. Have you ever visited there? It's a gem. And if you haven't had the opportunity to get there, I'm betting there may be a good chance after this program you'll be planning a visit, because we are going to be talking today with Molly Fifield-Murray. Molly is the Outreach Programs Manager for the University of Wisconsin Arboretum in Madison, talking with us about the Arboretum, but also about native plants. Do you have native plantings in your yard or garden area or your lawn area? Questions about that, how to incorporate them into your garden, perhaps? I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show. You can go there, and I always love to see garden photos. So if you've got some photos, some prairie photos, I'd love to see them and put them up on our Facebook page. That would be really cool. Again, join in with questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234 if you want to talk live with Molly. And Molly, great to have you back.
It's good to be here. Beautiful day.
Oh, it's a wonderful day across Wisconsin. And, you know, we do this, I think, every time. But for people who are not familiar with the UW Arboretum, the University of Wisconsin Arboretum is in Madison, talk about the different habitats and gardens that are represented there. This is a wonderful, wonderful place.
Well, the whole goal of the Arboretum originally was to not only have a horticultural display, which is quite famous with lilacs and crab apples and now hydrangeas blooming this time of year. And that's about 40 acres, but there are 1,200 more acres of restored ecological communities native to Wisconsin for the most part. And that was the goal of the Arboretum, to create teaching laboratories for the botany department and the landscape architecture department on campus. It's the first restored prairie in the world. Its birthday is this November, for 80 years ago.
80 years ago. Oh, my goodness. And it's always really a treat for me to come out and visit, frankly, at all times of the year. I like this time of the year a lot, and just a little later in the fall.
Well, the crowds don't come out just yet, and the prairie is spectacular with color. It turns color earlier than the woodlands, so it's already turned red and gold, but there are still, you know, the bright yellow sunflowers in bloom and many of the goldenrods. But the big blue stem is red and blue, and the Indian grass is gold. And then in mid-October, say, the woodlands, which are also restored, all planted trees for the most part, except for some of the older oaks. The maple woodlands are now mature, and they're pretty spectacular in the fall, too.
This is just a wonderful place to visit. And I, as you listen to the show today, I hope you'll kind of keep that in mind. You have a great website. I should just mention right off the bat, if people want to know how to get there, what's all there.
Right.
The website's great.
At arboretum.wic.edu. And of course, we have our Native Gardening Conference coming up on the 20th. And we decided to leave the registration open one more day for radio listeners to sign up and learn about planting their own native gardens if they wish to.
Well, I tell you what, I hope you'll join in, maybe join in on that, and also join in with your questions and comments. The number to call again, 1-800-642-1234. Just got to mention, I posted on our Facebook page a photo, Nancy Gardebrecht and Barbara Anderson, with the Northern Lights Master Gardeners in Marinette County, are sitting in on the show today, so it's wonderful to have them, and I couldn't resist getting a photo and posting it up on our Facebook page. So if you want to see those two, they're up on the page. And again, if you want to post your own photos, maybe you've got some cool native plant photos or native garden photos, I hope you'll post them up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Nancy in La Crosse has a question. So let's go to Nancy next. Thank you so much for calling. What's on your mind, Nancy?
Well, thanks for the wonderful show again, Larry. Your show just enriches our lives so much. I just don't know what we would do without it.
Oh, thank you.
But at any rate, I live in La Crosse, and we have lots of bluffs. And so when we moved into this house about 10 years ago, one hillside was all crown vetch, which I killed. And I'm about 6 years now into the prairie. And it's like a life of its own. It's like one of your own children. But the problem I have, that one of the mixes in it, and it was professionally mixed, is ryegrass. And it gets tall, and the hill is kind of steep, and the ryegrass always tips over and kind of creates this mess underneath it. And seemingly nothing grows much under it because it's so dense. So I guess my question is, like, is this a good thing, a bad thing? Can I manage it better? Can I cut it to keep it shorter? I mean, is this part of just having a prairie? I'm not sure what to do about this ryegrass.
Right. Do you know, are you talking about the native wild rye, one of the native wild ryes, or are you talking about a ryegrass that people put in their lawns?
A native ryegrass. It gets, near as I can tell, about 5 feet tall.
Okay, and it's by itself? There aren't forbs in there?
It's a mix of various grasses. One of them is the rye grass.
Okay.
And then various forbs, various sedges. There isn't large amounts of it, but what is there is tall, and it just, you know, bends over, unlike the blue stem that seems to be stay fairly erect.
Right. Well, rye grass does tend to bend over a little bit more than big blue stem or Indian grass. I guess I'm not familiar with a mix that would be so heavily rye grass that it would fall down and mat the rest of it. Have you burned the site at all?
I do. I burn it every year.
Okay.
Before it starts turning green on the hillside.
Okay.
It's not, as I said, not large numbers of it. It's just in the areas in the clumps that are there, it just falls over. And I would think that it would prohibit what's underneath it growing much. That's kind of my thought, but I don't know, you know, for sure. So
yep.
I don't know if it would work to, like, keep cutting it back so that it doesn't get so tall or...
No, I wouldn't do that. First of all, your prairie's very young, and it'll be different in a couple of years. I'm guaranteed, because they do that.
Yeah, they do, yep.
And the forbs in prairies are adapted to growing under the grasses that get taller. So if people would watch a prairie over time, you'll see that in the spring, the things that are in flower are very short, and they get taller as the year goes on. And that's not because they want to be taller. It's because they want to get up above the grasses and have their flowers available for the pollinators. But the things that bloomed in the spring are still underneath all of that. So they're well adapted to being shaded by the later things and even the falling over. The main thing would be to take off that duff in the spring. You don't have to burn every year, but you don't always want to burn the same time every year. So burning in the fall sometime, although if it's a really steep slope, you have to always worry about erosion. So you're juggling a few things there. You might think about burning in some strips instead of burning the whole patch at once sometimes. But, and particularly if you have it professionally burned, you can get
you
them
can do
to
that.
Do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't do that. And I guess I've always burnt it in the spring because within the mix, I have some daffodils and things, and I tried to burn it before they start coming up, but and before it gets and I like the habitat or the vegetation there in the winter for all the critters.
Sure.
Yeah, looks pretty in the winter, I'll bet.
Yeah.
Well, spring burns, particularly if it's a little bit late in the spring, tend to favor the grasses over the forbs. Now, if you're burning dormant season, that's not necessarily true, but you know, you might just try a little bit variation there. But once again, your prairie's very young, and I just wouldn't worry too much about anything staying the same from this point forward.
Mm-hmm. And take a photo of it, Nancy, and post it up on our Facebook page. Now you've got me really intrigued. I want to see what it looks like.
It's you know, I was really nervous about doing it initially because of the crown vetch, and people had said, oh, you'll never get rid of that stuff. But now 6 years out, I mean, for the most part, the prairie has taken over, and there's some that comes up, but by no means, I mean, it's very, very manageable, and we have minimal grass to mow. It's the best thing I've ever done in my life.
Thank you so much for calling in again. Take that smartphone out and take a photo or two and post it up on our Facebook page so we can have a look at it.
And it must be glorious now and monarchs coming by, I would suspect, if you have some goldenrods and asters. So
yeah, not a goldenrod now. It's the yellow.
Yeah. It undoubtedly a very beautiful place. Thank you, Nancy, so much for calling. And I'm, you know, she hasn't said she'll take a photo, but I'm hoping she will take a photo and post it up today yet before the show's over. I want to see it.
My has technology changed.
Hasn't it ever compared to when? Now you've been doing the show with me for how many years?
Oh, at least 20, I think.
At least 20 years, and things were a lot different 20 years ago.
Yeah.
That's
maybe
for
30.
Sure. Yeah, it could be. Well, again, you can join in. Maybe you have a question for us. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Quite a few. We have some Facebook questions. Let's get to some of those. Well, Linda sent a note. Can Molly name some native pollinating perennial flowers that will be useful to plant around our apple orchard at our elementary school, preferably ones that are flowering the same as apple blossom time?
Wow. That reminds me of a song, I think.
Yes.
Well, yes, it's wonderful to be thinking of that. And there's a lot of people who are working with farmers and orchardists to get them to plant wildflowers in their orchards to feed pollinators when the apples are not in bloom. So when the apples are in bloom, it's less necessary to have the wildflowers in bloom, although there are certainly some that would be valuable to have around, such as lupin or the golden Alexanders in the spring. But lupin is a big bumblebee attractor, as is Baptisia or the false indigos, and those are also bumblebee attractors. Bumblebees are very good pollinators of plants because they're very faithful to the plants they're visiting, and so they are definitely carrying the pollen from one plant to another. But another important thing for having bees in apple orchards is to provide food for them when the apples are not in bloom. So try to have a couple of species coming into bloom every couple weeks so that throughout the summer and into the fall. Right now, next year's queens are out, as well as the male bumblebees. And so it's important to have some of the goldenrods and asters in bloom right now. A showy goldenrod is a spectacular plant for pollinators, as is stiff goldenrod, and they bloom a little bit after each other. Showy goldenrod sort of being the last thing. A surprising thing to many people that we advocate is pasture thistle, Circeum discolor, and you'll see multiple bees and butterflies on a single head sometimes. It's so attractive to pollinators. It is not a thistle that's invasive. It does get tall, however.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a relatively soft thistle, and it's native, so it's not the one that's banned by your local township to stay away from. So having a variety of things for the pollinators is really important.
I love that idea, and it's great to know that. You just normally don't think, I hadn't thought about the fact we need some flowers in there when the trees aren't blooming, so
right. We've
got those pollinators helping them out.
Well, and I think a lot of farmers have forgotten. Of course, corn is mostly when pollinated, but farmers who grow soybeans, for instance, I asked one of them, well, what pollinates your soybeans? And soybeans isn't a native plant. And he said, well, I'm not sure. And in parts of the farm country, they're taking out hedgerows and taking out groves that were planted, and there's nothing for pollinators to go to when the soybeans aren't in bloom. And so what are they going to live on? They're not. So then you have to rely on commercial honeybee people to bring the honeybees around. But they're not doing very well, and that's an expensive proposition. It'd be much better to leave the
grove. Leave the hedgerows.
That has some wild plums in it and a hawthorn or two and maybe some goldenrods along the fence, and you'd be supporting bumblebees and other. There are a lot of wild bees that we don't think about as being pollinators, but many of them are, and they're very small. They live in the ground, many of them, or in old wood. And they're all important.
Very important. And our research shows that for sure. Molly Fifield-Murray, our guest today, she's the Outreach Programs Manager for the University of Wisconsin Arboretum in Madison, taking a look at sustainable gardening with native plants. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk as we visit about native plants today. Again, you can join us. I think there's one open line maybe at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Matt in Menominee Falls has been waiting a while, so let's go there. Matt, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Great program again.
Thank you.
The reason I'm calling is I hear and see a lot about trying to, continue the support of monarch butterflies, and milkweed is one of their main foods. And I see milkweed around all around, but I don't see any of them flowering or blooming. Is there something that milkweed needs to, be more productive or something?
Well, the milkweed. There are many species of milkweed. The one you see mostly is common milkweed. It tends to form clones because it spreads by roots, which is why some people don't like it near their garden or something like that. Not flowering, I'm not sure. They have to be a certain maturity to flower, so if they're young ones, they might not flower, particularly if they're young ones in a clone. The flower isn't as important to the butterfly as the plant is because it's the only food the larva can eat. So they lay their eggs on milkweeds, but they may nectar on many, many flowers. In fact, it's wonderful to have this campaign to plant milkweeds, plant millions of milkweeds. But what butterflies really need to get to Mexico right now are other flowers to get nectar on. So asters and goldenrods between here and Mexico are really, really important. And a lot of people think, well, I don't like goldenrod. I have allergies. But goldenrod is a very sticky pollen. It's pollinated by insects. And as I say in a talk, sometimes the only way to have a problem with goldenrod pollen is if the bee flies up your nose. So so right now we really, in addition to the milkweed, which is really important for the larva, and only about 5% of the eggs laid produce butterflies, so that's important to have lots of opportunity for that to happen. But then you do need to provide other things for the mature butterfly, particularly the last generation of them, to make that trek thousands of miles south, and then that generation comes north just a little bit into Texas and starts the next round. Now, why did the monarchs disappear? Partly it's the farming. Partly it was the severe drought in Texas, so there wasn't anything growing when they came out of winter. People report that they're seeing many more monarchs this year than they have for at least 5 years. And there are people who tag monarchs. There's some wonderful work being done at the University of Minnesota. There's pollinator partnerships. So a lot of these things we're paying attention to, but it's up to maybe those of us who have home yard gardens to provide this, because farming has become fence row to fence row, as we just talked about. And if groves are eliminated and there aren't hay fields anymore, wild hay or just grass hay with a few wildflowers in them, there's no place for these monarchs to stop over. In fact, if they take out the groves, I don't know whether they roost overnight, because they roost by the hundreds sometimes in a tree. So having some of these places in your yards might be the only thing that saves these. You'd hate to be the last generation to see monarchs,
that's for sure. Oh, that's for sure. You know, I had some milkweed that just came up volunteer, and I'm going to keep that. And
yes.
I kept it, and we had plenty of monarchs right there. And as I do a little three-mile jog in the morning around the neighborhood, and I'm noticing this year, as an example, many, many more little patches of milkweed in those flower gardens.
Right.
So.
And my daughter, who lives on the east side, has a little rain garden, and in it she has Liatris ligulostylus. Mm. And she can get 6 or 8 monarchs on one plant in the middle of Madison. It's just amazing. It's a monarch magnet. So if you are planting a prairie or a wildflower garden, look for the Liatris species for mid to late summer blooms, and then, like I said, the asters and goldenrods.
And Matt, thanks again for calling. I really appreciate your call. We had Christine in Brookfield up with a question for you too, Molly, so let's go there, and then we'll go back to some Facebook questions too. Christine, hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call here. I really love your show.
Thank you.
I'm a little starstruck right now. I have a problem with gray mold in my perennial garden, and I was wondering if it was something that I have done to it. It looks like kind of like rust at the roots of these plants, and the stems are kind of giving up the weight of the plant, and they all fell over. And it looks like they have kind of little limpets, like sticking on them, like little, I don't know how to explain it otherwise, little spots on the bottom that look like limpets from tide pool. I don't know what that is. And I was wondering if you did and if I could make that not happen again.
Yeah. Well, gardens need air circulation, so if your garden is a little bit too dense, you might be getting some issues. If you mulched it, and the mulch could have brought it in, so if it's actually damaging the plants, I would clean that garden really well this fall and remove the stems and any dead leaves and the top layer of mulch and see if that doesn't improve for next year. Now, a lot of plants this year have gotten the white mold-like on their leaves, which is a cosmetic issue, mostly because the rain has been coming and sporadically, but very wet for a while, and that causes, I'm forgetting the name of...
Powdery mildew, yeah.
Powdery mildew, thank you, yes. It's good to have a master gardener in the house. And a lot of people object to powdery mildew, and they won't plant things that get it, but it's really just a cosmetic thing.
And another thing you could do, Christine, is to get down there and take a couple of close-up photos and post them to Dr. Death, Brian Huddleston of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison, and he may have a comment for you. You can go to the plant. I think we have a link to it on our Facebook page, but just University of Wisconsin Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, post a couple of photos, explain what you got there, and Brian may have an additional answer or additional comment at least for you. So that'd be worth it too. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it very much. We have more callers, and we have lots of Facebook questions, and there was one that you wanted to talk about, which...
The gray dogwood.
Gray dogwood, yeah. Bob sent a note on Facebook who says, I have a gray dogwood started in my yard, and I'm curious as its suitability as a hedge. How long is it going to last? Do you have any pruning or cutting advice to keep it neat and viable? Cedar waxwing love the white berries, which are ripe right now. So gray dogwood.
Yes, gray dogwood is probably the most important native shrub for migrating birds because the white berry contains a lot of fat, and it's important for them. They stop over, they gobble it up, and then they can make their next 300 miles or however far they go in a night. It's not what I would consider a hedge plant, but it is a border plant. It will spread by roots, and you can mix it with some other native shrubs to have some diversity if you wish. We have a beautiful gray dogwood border at the native plant garden in the arboretum that is all white with berries right now, and the berries are on red stems, so it's pretty spectacular. The leaves are starting to turn sort of a maroon. If you want to see what that's like, I'm not sure how far you are at the Dells, you could come down and see us and see what that looks like to let a whole bunch of them grow. I tend to like to mix things in, so maybe behind the gray dogwood. If I had 10 gray dogwoods, and it will spread by roots, I'd probably stick in a nannyberry or an arrowwood or something to have a variety of berries available.
And we have Adam in Ellison Bay next with a question for you. Let's go there. Adam, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for the great program.
You bet. What's on your mind?
Well, my question is about where to procure native plants, the best way to do that. I also have another question, and then I'll take my answers off the air. The other question would be, what kind of native perennials are great for attracting beneficial insects around a vegetable garden? Thanks. I'll take my call off the air.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
Well, any of the native wildflowers are going to be, not actually all of them are pollinated by insects that would also pollinate your garden. But if you want tomatoes, you have to have bumblebees. So you want wildflowers that will support the bumblebees the rest of the year. If you have sun, those can be some prairie perennials. It doesn't have to be a full-blown prairie, although I really recommend planting some of the grasses with the prairie, not only because it's important in the root zone for the forbs, but because there are butterflies, surprisingly, that their larva is on grass, the skipper butterflies. And so if you had some prairie drop seed in with a few of the perennials, and once again, I would try to have a mix so you have a couple things blooming every week. So you would want to have 14, minimum 14 to 16 different species in there, plus a few grasses. More is better in some ways as far as diversity goes. And as far as where to get them, so up by you, I would contact the Wild Ones for a list of the nurseries closest to you. There's a nice Wild Ones group in Appleton that, or Oshkosh, that would have a list. There are many nurseries in the state. It's not like the old days where you only had one choice. And you can find them sometimes. People will call them wildflowers, but they might not be native. So be a little careful about that. I've seen stands along the roadside up in Door County selling wildflowers, and they were not local wildflowers. So I couldn't guarantee the hardiness of something that came from somewhere else. So it would be best if you were getting them from somebody who was growing them locally. And just the DNR used to have a list. I don't know if it's up to date, but you could also just Google native wildflower nurseries near me, and if you want to let Google know where you are. if you don't, you know, just say northeastern Wisconsin.
And the Wild Ones is a great idea. And you just go online and and type in Wild Ones in your county.
And their center isn't too far away from...
That's right. That's pretty close. So you'll get some great advice. And boy, there are some great nurseries here in the state now. Really, lots of really good ones. So very good advice. Mary in Milwaukee has a question for you. So let's go there. Mary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a fairly large prairie garden in the backyard. Well, actually, I have prairie garden in the front and the back and the sides, but the backyard started out with huge diversity of plants and grasses. And over the years, it has become a only a few plants. A lot of plants have disappeared for probably different reasons. But I'm getting this huge, like, monoculture of sweet Indian plantain, cup plant, wild garlic that I think I didn't plant that. That actually came in on its own. And what is the third one? But it's, like, out of control. And the sweet Indian plantain in particular is just going nuts everywhere. And I don't even particularly like that plant. I hate to say it. But,
and it's way over your head, I bet.
It's way over my head. And so, yeah, the garden's like just like Jack and the Beanstalk back there. It's just, everything is huge.
Oh, it sounds interesting, though, Mary. It does sound interesting.
It is. So I'm wondering what I can do to start eradicating the sweet Indian plantain. Even though I love the cup plant, it has become like, you know, huge, like monoculture within the middle of the garden. And, you know, I know that those root systems are very deep. So digging them out didn't seem like the best option, considering there's so much of it everywhere. It's spreading in. It's probably even spreading into the neighbors by now, too.
Okay. Well, what do you think, Molly?
Well, this is a little bit tough because they are popular plants with pollinators. We've been talking about pollinators a lot. And sweet Indian plantain, if it is sweet Indian plantain, it's not a widespread species, but it's widespread in your yard, so that's an issue. I wouldn't, just to go back to the seed mix, I wouldn't plant cup plant in a yard garden. And I probably wouldn't plant sweet Indian plantain either, although in a backyard I maybe would have. But in any case, prairies change over time, and these plants could be predicted to be aggressive. So what to do about it? I guess if you don't want to dig them out and you don't want to use herbicides, I would cut them off frequently so that you're diminishing the amount of energy that's going back down into the root system. So I'd cut them off right now, particularly. You don't want them to go to seed. The goldfinches are probably all over the cup plant and eating and spreading the seed. So go cut them off, trade the seed with somebody to get something else in there. What grasses do you have?
I have a big, I have a little bit of little blue stem, Indian grass, big blue stem. I used to have a lot of prairie drop seed, and now that is disappeared. I used to have blue joint grass. I used to have side oats grama. I used to have a lot of stuff, and it's just disappeared.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think you'll have to be pretty vigorous about cutting them back this fall. And then next spring when they start coming up, just keep cutting them back. You're not going to get rid of them, and you probably don't want to completely. But you'd weaken the root system, and other things would have a chance. Do you burn it at all?
No, I don't think they would like that.
Okay. So I would mow, after you cut it off, towards spring, I would cut everything down. And mulch that away from that particular garden, so those smaller things have a chance to come up.
Some of those small things, I think I can remember you saying this, could reappear.
Yes, the little blue stem and drop seed probably haven't gone away. There was a study done during the droughts of the 30s, and little blue stem went dormant for 9 years.
Oh my goodness.
Back. So it's probably still there. So if you give it a little space, it'll probably come back.
Wonderful advice. Thanks, Mary. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. We have, John in West Bend wondered, what are the advantages of having wasps on your native plants? Well, wasps can be pollinators too, can't they?
Wasps can be pollinators too. There's a lot of different wasps. They're not all evil. Although the German yellow jacket, which isn't native and is a ground nester, is very aggressive. And if you have an allergy to stings, or if you, like at the Arboretum, we have one of our workers is allergic to stings. And, of course, we have a lot of children. And so if we know about a yellow jacket nest, we'll get rid of it. It's a ground nesting, and it's difficult to get rid of. But one can do it, and as I said, it's not native. I would not worry about the native wasps and bees. Some of them look lethal, but I have never been stung. I take hundreds, if not thousands, of photos of pollinators and sticking my camera right in their noses, and sometimes they'll raise an arm at me. I can't see their fingers, so I don't know if there's anything there, but they do ask you to get out of their space. But some of them are huge. I mean, there's the great black wasp is a couple inches long.
Yeah.
There's the cicada-killing wasp that kills cicadas and puts it in its nest, but it also visits plants. There's the golden digger wasp that does. Some of these are getting nectar from the flowers, but they also kill other insects, and so they're beneficial in a number of ways to your garden. So wasps are considered in the group of pollinators that are worth keeping. And that's another thing about, you know, the rest of your space. The ground nesting bees in the arboretum, a lot of them live in the lawn. And some people wouldn't like bees in their lawn, but they're tiny little holes. They do make a little, you know, eighth-inch tall mound of dirt, but it's sort of interesting. They like sand in particular, some of them. So they're something to live with.
Yep, they sure are. We have lots of bees, more bees than bumblebees in particular this year. And it was great to see them. And they just go about their business. And
right.
I've never had any trouble with them, so happily. Jeff in Fox Lake has a question for you. So, Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, appropriate timing, I guess, for this question. Going back to the monarchs and other butterflies, if I have some rather large rough areas that I leave unmowed or untended for the year, and I got a lot of milkweed in there and some goldenrod, but there's also burdock, and so you got a mix of stuff that's like 4 feet tall, I'd like to go in and mow that, but I want to do it at a time when I'm sure not to disturb whoever needs to use those plants yet, specifically the milkweed. I'm wondering calendar-wise when it's a good time to be able to do that.
Well, I'd wait another week or so for the milkweed. There might be a caterpillar or two left, or certainly a chrysalis is around there somewhere. I'd do whatever I could to get rid of the burdock intermittent. I've seen some horrifying photos of birds caught in burdock, as well as well, even a tiny mammal. So burdock's not native, and its burrs can capture bluebirds and little tiny birds that don't know better. So burdock I'd get rid of. The others I'd wait on maybe a week or so. The goldenrod, you know, as long as it's flowering, you don't need to let it go to seed if you don't want, but leave it while it's flowering if you can.
There we go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking about native plants today with Molly Fifield Murray, the Outreach Programs Manager for the University of Wisconsin Arboretum in Madison. Larry Mueller here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network for this edition of Garden Talk. I should mention, next Friday on Garden Talk, we're joined by one of our wonderful UW Extension horticulture educators, Erin LaFave from Eau Claire County. So looking forward to that. Today, having lots of fun with Molly Fifield Murray, the Outreach Programs Manager for the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum. And, you know, your annual Arboretum Conference, I did want to mention that. It's coming up Sunday, September 20th, so it's a bit away yet, but early in the day, 8:45 to 4:30, isn't it?
Right, it's all day, and it's from people who are just beginning. We have an introduction to how to get started. We have a really nice session on how to manage your wildflower gardens from our wildflower garden, Susan Carpenter. We have a section on seeds, so if you've been gardening for a while and you have seeds that you want to collect and do something with, we have something on trees and shrubs. We have a new one this year on the more ornamental native plants that you can use in your garden, and we have a session on pollinators. In addition, coming up this fall, we have some interesting classes. One is on forest gardening, and that's on October 3rd. You can sign up online at arboretum.wisc.edu. And then I'm teaching a course on creating rain gardens later in October. So
lots going on there.
Yeah, and then, you know, stop by for a visit.
Yeah, stop by for a visit for sure. And your keynote address, I thought, was kind of cool for your conference, which is Wild Gardening with Art and Purposefulness, which is a hard word to say.
Yes.
Purposefulness.
And it's Nancy Ayton from the Milwaukee area, is an award-winning landscape architect.
Yeah.
Like myself, she's a student of Daryl Morrison's, who sort of helped get native landscaping going again in the area. And she's a charming speaker and well-versed in how you should design your areas.
So take a look at the website. Go to the website at the Arboretum, at the UW Arboretum, and you're going to find out a whole lot more about it. I definitely did want to mention that because, man, talk about, you know, how to design one, native pollinators, creating children's spaces in gardens. There's planting and maintaining your garden, how to manage your land and backyard to help birds.
Right.
How to use ornamental native plants in the landscape, collecting seeds. And then a native plant garden tour.
Right.
Wow. Talk about a day. Your head's going to be ready to explode after a day like that. Man, my head's exploding here because I'm trying to figure out where to go next. Let's go to Bob in Lancaster. In the meantime, by the way, you can join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And we have open lines, so we can get you on pretty quickly. So give a call. Now we'll go to Bob in Lancaster. And again, Bob, thanks a lot for calling.
Good morning. I've got about 100 milkweed plants in a vacant lot that I purposely didn't cut. And I'm letting them go to maturity. And I'm trying to think, people that are interested in planting them on their own property and so on, when's the best time to harvest the pods? And do you let them dry completely? Do you wait till they split, or do you plant them in the fall and let them germinate, you know, stratify in the soil? Do you wait till the spring?
Well, you wait till they're mature and getting dry and starting to split, and then collect the seed before the wind sends them into the air. Separate the chaff from the seed if you want to take the time. You don't have to do that. Planting in the fall tends to be favorable for many wildflowers. You might have some predation from mice or voles or chipmunks or something, but they're naturally stratified that way. They get most wildflowers in Wisconsin need to go through a winter before the seed will germinate, because that's what they're adapted to.
Sure.
Unless they bloom in the spring and the seed is ready in June and that drops, sometimes something like lupin would germinate within 2 days of falling. But this time of year, the plants will need to go through winter. If you don't plant them right away, but you have them stored, they still need to go through a winter of some kind. Lots of people put their dry seed in a paper bag, and maybe even in a plastic bag, and hang it from a rafter so the mice can't get to it. Let it stay cold over winter. It doesn't. Milkweed seeds, I don't think, need to be wet stratified. I mean, it never hurts, but I don't wet stratify if I'm not going to be watering the plantings. So just getting them out and planting wildflowers in the fall tend to do well with that. If you plant your prairie in the spring, the grasses seem to get a head start.
Alrighty, thank you.
Yeah, sure, thanks a lot, Bob, for calling. And Carol in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I'm in the Milwaukee area, actually Shorewood, just north of the city, a few blocks from the lake. But in any event, I do have a lot of native plants in my garden, my little urban gardens, and I've even been raising monarchs. But what I've noticed, and I understand the Arboretum had this issue with these jumping worms, and I did discover a couple in my garden in June, and I noticed the leaf litter is pretty gone, and I'm wondering, I did find some this last week as well, and I'm wondering if there's anything that can be done that would be safe to use to manage them.
Yeah, that's getting to be a problem.
We don't have an advisory yet for what to do about the jumping worms that I know of. I would keep checking with the DNR's website on this because they're going to be the ones who figure it out. They're doing experiments both at the Arboretum and other places around the state. Right now, we're not doing any treating experiments at the Arboretum so much as we're trying to figure out how fast they move, and I don't mean how fast they jump, but...
They do jump fast, but yes. I also know that, you know, I have a bank in front, and I notice that there really isn't any leaf litter there, you know, it's
right.
Pretty just open soil, and so are you seeing damage on the native plants that you do have, all the native plants in the areas where you do have the jumping worms?
Well, what they do, as you're pointing out, is they do remove the leaf litter, and I don't think we know the long-term consequences of that, but they're quite worried of what that will do, particularly in natural forests. I just learned yesterday that they are in one of our woodlands. They've gotten there probably from the mulch yard that's not very far away, or tracked on shoes, etc., however they get moved around. I think they're probably here to stay, unfortunately, but if we can keep them out of the natural areas, that will be really important. What it's going to mean for your garden, I don't know. I mean, you could keep adding mulch in a garden to some extent, particularly if you have leaves fall and rake them or mulch them up with a mower and put them back down. There was some hope that they would be set back by a very hard winter. We had a pretty cold winter, but we also had snow cover. So what we really need, but none of us really want, is a very cold winter with no snow and see if that sets them back significantly. But we don't know yet. And, you know, they've found them at the Arboretum, but once they've found out they were in the state, they've been finding them lots of places. So they're all around the state, and... we just, those of us who are gardening and see them, first of all, it's pretty startling, isn't it?
Yeah, really.
The kids like them when they come to the Arboretum and see them. The boys especially, Larry.
Yeah, I don't like them. But I have covered some parts of my garden, a bank that gets sun in the winter when I don't want a thaw to happen in January, with boughs to keep it cool. But
yes.
Would you suggest I still do that? Or is that something that's protective of these worms, or don't we know?
I don't think we know. We probably want they don't go very deep. They're not like the earthworm. So all the worms I'm backing up. All the worms in the state are not native. Even the big night crawlers.
There isn't a single one
No.
that's native.
No, because the glacier eliminated them. And so anything that's come in since then has been brought in. So it's the European night crawler that we see. It's the red worm that's been brought in for composting and things. The night crawler hasn't been as big a worry, although it does also eat the leaf litter more quickly than would have happened without it. But I think this jumping worm is so prolific and eats the mulch so fast that the biggest concern are the natural forests, particularly up north, I think.
Yeah. And thanks again for calling, Carol. Appreciate your call. It's a worry for sure. Eric in Appleton has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Eric. Thank you for calling.
My pleasure. I have a question about a tree in my backyard. It's been growing now for a couple of years. I didn't plant it, and recently I have been trying to identify it and determine it's a mulberry tree. And I understand that there are the white mulberries and red mulberries, and one is native and one is invasive. So I'm wondering what to do with it, if I should keep it, if I should try to identify if it's red or white, or if I should just... take it down, since it could be potentially an invasive species.
I'm not sure that there's a native mulberry. The red mulberry is native in Indiana. I'm not sure it's native in Wisconsin. The white mulberry is the one that is, for the silk industry that didn't work. So
right,
yeah.
Red mulberry apparently is not common. It's more an Ohio River Valley kind of tree. So whether that's the one you have, I guess I would try to figure out which one it is and see if it's where you would like a tree and it's the red mulberry and you don't mind the fruit falling, you could probably be okay.
So it's kind of hard to identify, but if it is the whites, is that something that I should take down?
Well, that's up to you, but
I'd take it down.
I would, yes.
I'd take
it down. What'd you say, Larry?
I'd take it down if it's a white.
Okay.
He's offering to come by with his chainsaw.
I've got it all. You know, vroom, vroom, we're ready to go. Thanks a lot. You should be able to get that identified.
There's a difference. Well, certainly in the fruit, but there's a slight difference in the leaves.
Yeah. And Facebook from Margie, when's the best time to burn your prairie without killing the herps that live there?
Ah, well, that's been a debate for a long time, and there's experiments going on just about that very question, especially with some very rare butterflies called the regal fritillary in very dry goat prairies, and how often would they have burned? And statistics would say maybe not once every 6 years or so, but if you let a prairie, particularly a prairie that's been invaded by woody shrubs, go for 6 years, then it's a woods.
Oh, then it's a woods.
And that's not good for the regal fritillary either. So it's best if you have a large property to not burn the whole thing at the same time.
So don't burn it all at the same time. Stagger it a bit, and hopefully that'll work for the herps. Our guest today, Molly Fifield Murray, she does a wonderful job, doesn't she? She's the Outreach Programs Manager for the University of Wisconsin Arboretum in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thank you so much for joining us today for this edition of Garden Talk as we talk native plants with Molly Fifield Murray, Outreach Programs Manager for the UW Arboretum in Madison. So much fun to have her along, and thank you so much for listening and for calling in. If you have a question, I hope you'll join in, or maybe an experience to share. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. And our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show. Post on that. And if you've got a great photo, I hope you'll post that as well. And Molly, as we look at the Facebook page, I'm looking at one that Maddie sent, a photo, which is a beautiful photo. She says, we've been busy tagging monarch butterflies at Madison Audubon Society's Goose Pond Sanctuary near Arlington in Columbia County, and we're seeing good numbers of monarchs. We've tagged over 325 monarchs. That's a lot of tagging. Meadow Blazing Star is the monarch's favorite nectar plant, and we have caught over 150 monarchs in our plot of 20 Meadow Blazing Star plants in our backyard. Conservation photographer Arlene Kozlil, I'm sorry, I'm mispronouncing that, Kozlil's photos of monarch tagging are attached. So, and she's got some more information there, but isn't that a beautiful photo?
Yes, and it's a beautiful plant. This is once again the Laetus ligulostylus or the Meadow Blazing Star. Now, how do you tag a monarch? Well, they have tiny little tags that are maybe about an eighth of an inch, and you put it at a very specific place on the wing, and apparently it doesn't interfere with their flying. And you have to catch them in a net, of course, to do this. Mm-hmm. Hold them very carefully, their instructions along on how to do it. And then if somebody finds this tag, they can report how far that monarch went.
That is very, very cool, and it's a beautiful photo. So go take a look on our Facebook page if you want to see that photo. It's gorgeous. You know, Adam sent us a photo as well. He said the honeybees were just swarming these beachfront plants in southern Door County, and he's got a photo of the plants, and I'm trying to figure out what they are. Molly, do you have a good guess on what they might be?
Well, one of them has a yellow center, so it might be one of the asters that would be blooming right now. It could be silky aster. There might be some special beech plants that I'm not familiar with, but it has a little bit of a look of silky aster.
Yeah, it's that's a good possibility. And let's see, while we're at it, we might as on Facebook here, we might as well go down. Oh, Susan sent a photo of photo that she took of. What do we got here? We got a butter. Is that a?
That's a hummingbird moth.
Oh,
a snowberry clear wing moth that acts like a hummingbird. Has a very long tongue, and it's coming to Monarda, which is a wonderful pollinator to plant to have in the middle of the season.
Yeah, and a beautiful shot again. Adam sent a shot. It just says, I love to watch the bees and butterflies bumble about these plants that he's got. Kind of a nice silhouette shot of his prairie area. Josh sent a photo. I planted a small native flower garden and included a few berry bushes. My currants don't seem to be doing well. The leaves were all withered around the edges, while the majority of the leaf did fine, and they never got better or worse. Any ideas why? And then he includes a photo of his favorite native flower, the bee balm. It's a very beautiful flower picture as well.
Right. The bee balm he's showing is not the native one, Monarda fistulosa. This is the darker red one that's quite common in gardens but still popular with insects. I can't answer the question about the currants. That might be something to ask the extension or Dr. Death.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me give that number again. I'm surprised you don't have a call here. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Lots of other questions, those. Actually, a caller, Chris from Wisconsin Dells, wonders if you could talk about how to deal with an unruly prairie. I know a friend whose prairie is being threatened by the state because it's so out of control, and I'm having a hard time imagining that.
Maybe it's all that cumplant and sweet Indian plantain. I don't know. It's prairies are wild places. Maybe he's talking about in a yard. And maybe it's too tall for the neighbors. That still can be an issue. What I like to suggest to people, if the neighbors might object to their prairie garden, is to make sure that the edge that meets the neighbors is grass. Mow a width or two around your prairie garden so that it's not right in the neighbor's face. And then I tend to shy away from very tall things. Particularly in the front yard of a neighborhood that has typically neat lawns. Mm-hmm. You'd like your garden to be appreciated and attractive as opposed to necessarily being sort of in your face, so to speak. And so if it's unruly, it might need to be tamed a little bit so as not to lose the whole thing.
An email question from Bill. It just says, Creeping Charlie. Is it true that Creeping Charlie is not actively managed in the Arboretum? And if so, why not?
I think I know who this Bill is, but nonetheless, that's true. In the spring, when Creeping Charlie is in bloom, sometimes it's a very important plant for the bees. And so we have been less aggressive about removing it. We certainly don't treat it with pesticides, and we might pull it out of a bed this time of year so that it has to creep back in the spring, but it's very popular with the bees, and it might be the one thing that gets them through a bad spell when the trees don't bloom.
John in Iowa wonders, what's the trick for germinating New Jersey tea?
Well, New Jersey tea has a very hard seed. It would need to be stratified, probably scarified. I think it's one of the ones that needs boiling water. But many of the nurseries give you instructions, and you can probably also look this up if you are friends with the Google and can look it up. But you could... if you've gotten it from a nursery, they should give you instructions. If you have collected it yourself, you still might be able to look in some of the nursery catalogs. Prairie Nursery or Prairie Moon Nursery usually have germination instructions with their seeds.
Yeah. And a Facebook question from Charlie. Can you talk about the value or benefit of grasshoppers and crickets in the native prairie?
The value. I don't eat them. Some people do. Nah. But they make very nice music. And they provide food for birds.
Yeah.
So sometimes something might not be something we're partial to personally, but they're an important part of the ecosystem. And we learned a lot about this from Doug Tallamy and his book, Bringing Nature Home, where he talked about the value of ecosystems and the value of individual species for other creatures besides ourselves.
Yeah.
So sometimes we only think of ourselves when we're planting a tree, and the most widely planted tree along roadsides, for instance, is the Norway maple. It supports no other life.
Yeah.
And yet oak trees support 400 other species of life, 400 plus. So if we were going to think about the ecosystem and think about what eats grasshoppers, what role grasshoppers have in the native prairie, then we wouldn't mind having them. And like I said, right now they make quite beautiful music, if you mm-hmm. don't mind. And in fact, we have a special night walk at the Arboretum just to listen to them and the snowy tree crickets. So.
Oh, well, they are beautiful to listen to. You're absolutely right. Nice comment. Donna in Milwaukee has a question for you. Hi, or a comment,
hey.
I should say. Hi, Donna.
Good morning, or good afternoon, I guess now. The question, well, I got a comment and kind of a question. I had some milkweed. I have the tall milkweed with the beautiful smelling flowers in my yard, along with lots of the little stuff that I found didn't always know was milkweed. The little stuff is all flowering, but the big ones, not so much. A couple years ago, I got huge blooms. The last couple years, they were kind of wilted and didn't last long and not quite that much. And this year, and I have some new milkweed that showed up in another place, and I would say I'm in the city, so it's not like a lot, but I have like four or five plants in my yard this year that are tall, the big, I think what's called the common milkweed.
Mm-hmm.
And one out of the five plants got flowers. I mean, I think it's a little late now. They're not going to get flowers now, are they?
No.
No. Mm. And they have a fair amount of sun. One thing I noticed, though, is the milkweed by the one area where the newer milkweed came up, when I kind of walked by there all the time, it was the earwigs were in the top branches all the time during the day. I don't know if they were the babies or what, but they would, I mean, I'd knock them out of there, but then the next day a couple days later, they'd all be back. Do you think they would have affected the blossoms coming?
Well, they wouldn't affect the blossoms coming, and they're probably not earwigs, I'm guessing. So milkweed is sort of like the oak tree in that it supports many forms of life, and in many cases, it's the only plant that these forms of life live on. So there's something called the large milkweed bug. It has sort of a black X on the back, but it goes through five instars of tiny little ones about the size of a double period or something, a little bit bigger than a period, to a full-sized one that's maybe 3/4 inch long and large orange and black. And then there's the small milkweed bug. Then there's the milkweed beetle, which is also red and has big horns on it. And then you'll often see soldier beetles on milkweed that aren't always just on milkweed, but those others are just on milkweeds. Yes, some of them do eat the flowers. I don't think they keep the flower from emerging at all, but they will eat them off, as will, I've seen numerous monarch caterpillars just eating the flowers this year, particularly on butterfly weed, which is the orange-looking milkweed. So once again, it's a tiny little ecosystem there with lots of things going on. And if it doesn't flower, that's not a problem for the monarchs. Right. Milkweed has a very intricate flower, and the only way it gets pollinated is if a very heavy and strong insect accidentally puts its foot down into the flower and pulls out this thing called a pollinium, which looks like a little saddlebags. And the saddlebags are two little sacks of pollen. But some bees get stuck there and never are able to get their foot out. And other, you know, some bees are so light that they just go over the top. So pollinating milkweed flowers is quite complex. You need large bumblebees or you know, strong butterflies to do it. Nonetheless, they usually are pollinated if they bloom. So why they might not be blooming, once again, I'm not sure why that would be. Something with the weather, maybe, or, you know, they bloomed so much last year, they were resting a year.
Could you do it with a Q-tip?
No, you couldn't. You could, you know, I've, Ken Wood, bless his soul, used to teach us how to do it by taking a needle grass, piece of needle grass, which is a very, like a harpoon.
Oh, my goodness.
And sticking it down in there and pulling out this pollinium. And I've seen photographs of them. I've taken them myself, although when I took the photograph, I didn't know the pollinia was on the bee's leg because it's a tiny thing. But it's sort of stuck in there, and it's a complex flower, a highly evolved plant. To have all these insects that just are on it, and to have this complex flower.
It's really fascinating.
Yeah.
Donna, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate it very much. Jay in Ferryville has a question for you. So, Jay, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Greetings. Well, first of all, you know, in a wok or in a pan, you cook up some grasshoppers in coconut oil with salt and your favorite pepper powdered. Yeah, you're fantastic, and you're like 22% protein.
They're very high protein. You're exactly right about that, Jay.
Go for it.
They're so much fun to eat with the kids. Anyways, the thing I wanted to know about was bottle Johnson.
Yes.
And this year I happened to find a patch of white ones.
It's a different species.
Pardon?
It's a different species. It's called cream gentian, but it's also closed like the bottle gentian. It's gentian flavida, and it's a rare species because it grew on top of where a lot of rock quarries are. So it's not as common as the bottle gentian, the blue bottle gentian.
That's what I usually find. Yeah, this is absolutely beautiful, and it's in ground that was dug up after 150 years of the final spillway going into the Mississippi. Very interesting, though. There's a bunch of plants that nobody else has seen in a long time that have come up out there.
That's when you should shoot a photo of that one and post that up on our Facebook pages. I would really like to see what that looks like, to be perfectly honest. If you've got a photo, post it up.
Go back out there and take one.
Yeah, go back out, take one, and post it up on our Facebook. Thanks a lot, Jay, for calling. Appreciate it. That's cool. I'm going to go back to our Facebook. And speaking of Facebook, we've got, here's a bottle, gentian in the field with goldenrod aplenty from Deborah, a shot there. And Jeff, I think, had a photo, too. What do we got from Jeff? Jeff's, my goodness, what do we got there? We got some monarchs, and we got some beautiful flowers there, aren't they? Boy,
it's an aster. Might be New England aster. I can't see the leaves close enough
to tell, but they're really beautiful. Lots of nice photos up there. Angela in Pelican Lake, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, I'm planning on starting a native plant garden, or a few of them, actually. And what I've done with my other gardens is I was raising worms for about 7 to 10 years ago. I started, and I put a big worm bin in the middle of my garden, so I had a place to put all my food throughout the winter. And then as it defrosted, it all went down into the worms, and they ate it, and everything was great. And then plants start growing out of it all the time. And what I noticed is every time I take plants out of here and put them somewhere, they're really super healthy plants. And everything that is around my worm bin is just, like, so healthy, and I never have problems with diseases or anything. And I was wondering, can I do this with the native plants? And is there anybody else out there doing this that I could correspond with and get some information from?
Well, of course, worms are eating vegetative material and decomposing it and turning it into really fertile compost. So that's why the plants are doing well there. And native plants would do okay there, but so will weeds that will compete with them. So the interesting thing about planting native plants is that it's usually recommended to not fertilize the soil and not to amend the soil when you're planting native plants, because they can take care of themselves. And if you fertilize the soil, particularly with quick-release commonly available fertilizers, you are just encouraging trouble. You're encouraging weeds that can take advantage of that. You know, the fertilizers are developed for those plants in that are crops for the most part, or lawn grasses, and they need sort of instantly available energy. It's sort of like giving your kid a candy or orange juice, instant energy. But the mature prairie plants don't need that.
Well, there we go. Thank you so much. We have Cheryl in Conover. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you? We own 2.4 acres up in Conover on a rural road with lots of evergreens and trees. And originally it used to be land for grazing for the farm that happens to be right next to us. So what I encouraged my husband to do was to stop mowing as much as around our house. I want to mow because of the fire hazard, obviously. And we stopped mowing, and I have milkweed and goldenrod and purple flowers and blue flowers. And then I bought those wildflower spreads that you just kind of throw out into the field. And I bought boxes of them and I put them out there. And I cannot tell you how awesome it is.
You know, it sounds pretty pretty.
Yeah. Well, I would think Larry would like to see a photo of that.
Now I want to see a photo of that one too. Darn it, Cheryl! You got to send me a photo. We're starting to run out a little bit of time here, but there are good native prairie seeds that you can do that with.
Yes, you have to be a little cautious when you buy. There used to be something, and I don't know if it's still available. It was called Meadow in a Can, or you could buy seed mixes that were prairie or called wildflower mixes, and you have to look at where they came from, because the biggest nurseries in the country are in Oregon and Oregon State, and they will put together seed mixes of what they call wildflowers, but they have things in them like Dame's Rocket, which we consider an invasive plant. But you can certainly find good wildflower mixes, even at the garden stores that you're going to for fall bulbs. They're going to have native mixes and individual species there from the nurseries in the state. We should probably get to the question about the pasture thistle, and I think they wanted a specific name, and so that's Circium, which is C-I-R-S-I-U-M, maybe, discolor, discolor being the species name. And it's very soft on the back of the leaf and white. It does have some thistle prickles on it, but not as many as you would think. It does have a thistle flower that's quite beautiful, but not as prickly or small as some of them.
All right. And with that, we are out of time. Molly, thank you so much. Always a pleasure. Look forward to your next visit.
Yeah, great fun.
Molly Fifield-Murray, Outreach Programs Manager for the University of Wisconsin Arboretum in Madison. And please take a look at their website, the Arboretum website, because we talked about a few of the events that are coming up there, and there's lots of really good stuff coming up and happening at the Arboretum. And gee whiz, thank you so much for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Again, thanks for listening.